CITR 101.9 FM. This is Ink Stud Show, the radio show where we talk about... What do we talk about, Mariel?
Studs.
There we go. Someone said something. Mariel's just staring at me. This is really uncomfortable. I'm really unimaginative. And I didn't join into the CITR show swap this week or this year thing. I've got an exam later. So I'm playing a pre-recorded interview I did last month with Chris Von Zombathy. He's a local Vancouver illustrator, painter, wonderful artist. He has a book from Drawn and Quarterly called Fire Away, and it's fantastic. It's really imaginative, beautiful colors, textures, layers, general types of awesomeness. So check it out, Fire Away. And yeah, I'll be back next week, hopefully... ready to rock some more. And oh yeah, this is part of my month-long focus on Canadians in comics. Chris has been nominated for an award, the Doug Wright Awards. I think it's the Doug Wright Awards, which will be given away on August 8th. So hopefully he gets one, because he's a cool dude. And he will be at the Comics and Stories Comic Convention at the Vancouver Art Gallery on August 24th. So if you want to come meet him, come on down. Bye-bye. This is Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. This is one of those on-location interviews. No phone here. My guest today is Chris Von Zombathy. Did I get it right?
That's right, yeah.
Did I actually get it right?
It depends, actually, on if you're going by the original Hungarian pronunciation or the English pronunciation. But I think that's actually pretty close to the Hungarian one. I just usually say Von Zombathy, but it's... You know, it kind of changes depending on who actually is doing it and who's spelling it.
It is quite a complex spelling. Why don't you tell people how it's spelled?
V-O-N space S-Z-O-M-B-A-T-H-Y.
So there we go. Your new book from Fantagraphics, or from Drawing Quarterly. Oh, bad me. I did this once before. Someone I got yelled at on the phone because it was about their own book. Drawing Quarterly, Fire Away, part of the Petit Livre book. See, my French is horrible. So.
Pronunciation's a lot better than mine.
Chris is one of those folks here, Vancouverite, well, most of the people doing these books. Actually, a surprising amount of Vancouver folks.
A very surprising amount of Vancouver.
Because there's you, there's Julie Morstadt, Tim Horsick.
Is that
how you pronounce his name?
I think that is how you pronounce his name.
He's from Richmond.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Mark Bell, Vancouver boy.
Yeah.
Keith Jones was in Vancouver. He's not anymore.
I don't know. He might be in Montreal, maybe?
Toronto?
Maybe?
We'll find out. Yeah, I'm hoping to interview him as part of this. This is going to be part of my month in Canadian comics I'm doing in July.
Oh, cool.
Even though this isn't a comic, you're published by Drawing Quarterly, and so I'm going to try and do a bunch of the Petit Livre books. So why don't you tell, who are you, Chris?
That's a really good question, actually. I'm, and I say it, I guess technically I consider myself to be just a producer, really, of just musical and art kind of ideas. I mean, it sounds really pretentious to say, you know, I'm a producer of things.
Well, we are sitting in Naga Hide chairs right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm drinking a glass of scotch.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll get some cigars afterwards.
There we go.
But pretty much, yeah, I mean, my background is kind of in fine arts, you know, in quotations, in fine arts, and music for the most part. I didn't really... I went to Emily Carr for about 4 years, and I left with a semester to go.
Oh!
I couldn't do it anymore. And I had this... I didn't actually start making visual work again of any type until, like, 2006.
Wow.
Which was about a three-year break. I left school to join this band that was doing pretty well in town, and... I went to go see Kids in the Hall with my sister, and we parked the car in the library parkade, and we got back to the car, somebody had broken into it, and they had taken nothing except for my sketchbook and one CD, and it was kind of like this weird omen. And after that I was so depressed.
That's an odd, especially that area. Like,
yeah,
I could see them grabbing anything.
Anything, yeah.
They put the sketchbook.
They left my clothes all over the parkade floor, and they left a trail of my various crap going all the way from the car. And then I found everything. The only thing they took was my bloody sketchbook and one CD. And after that, it just kind of killed me. And I couldn't work anymore. It was totally this kind of, you know, that book was kind of everything to me, so... said to heck with it. So I guess now I'm I got asked to come and do a show at some really small gallery called Works Division, which is at Gorham Powell. It's been shut down by the city about a couple of years ago.
Remember. Oh, that was the two floor place, right?
Yeah.
I used to live a block from there, had friends that had a skate party thing in there. And
oh, I know which one you're talking about, actually. I don't know if it's the same building. It was close. Okay. It was a two-floor, too. The skate place was a little bit down the block.
Oh, okay. See, this was right in the corner of Gorham Powell.
Yeah, this maybe is the same place.
They had two spaces. They had the crack pipe down the street, which was this huge, long warehouse space.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about, is the
But then
pipe.
They also had this house, and I lived a block away, and they would have, like, barbecues on the roof. And
that's right. Yeah, that's the same place. But I think it might have been right... after those guys.
Yeah, no, that. It was, I remember when it got turned into an art space, and I was like, oh, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah, the Kimura building. It was a beautiful building, and it's a real shame that city shut it down, because that building has a real illicit past. It was a brothel, it was a speakeasy, it was a grow-op. You know, it was just, yeah, it was a historic place. I mean, this one of the first places in the city they, or even Canada, they made their own sake because the two guys, the Japanese brothers that built it.
Really?
Yeah, it was originally a grocery store, and they had a sake distillery in it as well. And so those guys, my friend Kennedy Telford is a really amazing painter. He's actually loved his paintings there. No, everyone on radio can't see them, but
they're on the wall.
They're on the wall, and they're fantastic. He asked me to come back and do a show, and I said sure. And then as soon as that happened, it just kind of started to snowball, kind of from there. And then was happy making work again. So
nice.
I'm fairly happy now, so it's all good.
Now let's get a little bit, descriptive into your work, and maybe how you got connected with Drawn and Quarterly.
Yeah.
Because it's not, I mean, it is pretty interesting that you're not really like their normal little art book stuff.
Yeah, that is true. And to tell you the truth, you know, actually, you know, meeting with them, per se, was a real surprise to me. I'd finished pieces of a book, maybe about 10 or 12 different paintings, which I thought would maybe be good illustrations. And so I had some connections here and in New York and Toronto and Los Angeles, and I just sent my portfolio out to all these people. I'd never met them before.
Yeah.
And as it goes, it was like crickets. I didn't hear anything. But I didn't know anybody at Drawn and Quarterly. I wasn't even really aware of how, don't want to sound like, you know, like I'm blowing smoke up anybody's rear, but I wasn't realize how big they were, what their kind of presence was, or, mm-hmm. you know, or what their reputation was. Because I was not really a heavy comics follower, in a certain sense. I grew up with a lot of comics, and I still do read comics, but it's generally not hip.
Or... You're not running to the store to make sure you have a copy of the new Chris Ware book.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? It's like, my background is like Chester Gould's. It's like a real big hero of mine, and obviously like Robert Crumb is really big, and Jim Davis,
Garfield. I was gonna say, do you mean Jack Davis? Jim Davis.
Ooh. I like Jack Davis too, but I didn't discover him until later. But Jim Davis, I mean, I still have a huge amount of Garfield paraphernalia. I still love Garfield, and I still read Garfield, and I think about Garfield a lot. Archie comics, stuff like that. But I ended up finding them online and just sending them a portfolio. And I was actually just looking for feedback. I was just kind of like, well, these guys do publishing of some stuff that's similar, because I have some of this, my stuff like, is very kind of like comics based, or has a cartoony kind of base, or a graphics based advertising kind of stuff. And I just sent them basically a portfolio, and I was really shocked because it was literally like, 2 weeks after I sent it, they sent an email, and the first thing they said was, do you want to do a book? And it was really crazy because, I was really excited. I mean, I was really, really excited.
Yeah.
But my friends who knew of Drawn and Quarterly had been following their work, or, you know.
Yeah.
And they were losing their minds. You know, they were just like, I can't believe it. The funny thing was that, I mean, as excited as I was, and I was really excited and still continue to be really excited by it, and really feel like really honored, it didn't really hit me until I went to Chapters. And I was just like mulling around Chapters, and then I saw they had like a bunch of these Drawn Quarterly books in there, and I was like, holy crap, this is like a real thing, you know? Yeah. Like, I know Chapters is kind of like, it's kind of like a really bad way to kind of, you know, demark what you're
It's not like you're going into Lucky's up the street.
Yeah, something, exactly. You know, Chapters is just so corporate and so huge and so like all-encompassing and kicking out the small business guy. It just seemed really crazy that it was the same company involved. I mean, maybe it says a lot more about me than it does about anything they've done, but it just, that was for me was like a big thing, because I kind of at that point realized I was like, holy crap, like, my friends really weren't kidding me. Like, this is really something. And then I got nervous. And then I realized I still had to finish a book, and, you know, I was sweating.
So how much stuff did you already have prepared for the book before? And, like, what did you have in mind as far as the book went?
I had about 20% of the book done before. A lot of the sculptures in that book were from that first show, of like leftover stuff. Some of the sketchbook drawings were from older sketchbooks. Some of them going back to like maybe like 2001, 2000.
That's like the bicycle drawings.
Yeah, those were back in my like.
Is that the same stuff that was? Because there's some stuff that kind of seems separate to me. It's like the stuff with like the kind of more personal self-deprecation writing, like the really anxious, lonely stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. They came out of very similar periods, but there actually were a lot of the writing stuff was one period, and then the purely visual stuff was right after. And that was kind of a conscious choice, at least that I made myself, to kind of do away with the text for a couple different reasons. But I think one of the main ones was that there's a lot of that kind of comic and text-based kind of work kind of going around. It's not comic-y, and it's, I don't want to say it's fine art. It's just this kind of DIY stuff. And I enjoy it. But I think I wanted to mentally kind of give myself some kind of break. Mm-hmm. And just be like, okay, like that's, I want to say that's these people, but that's one thing. And I explore
it's kind of like the Jason McLean school.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, really good. But I mean, when my sketchbook got stolen, that whole book was like that. And I still have, if I have a couple photocopies of the drawings, and I mean myself personally, I was at the peak of my game. I was really at like, you know, that's like, I was really drawn, son. Like, I was really doing it. And, I felt so good about that book, and I had a lot of text in there as well. So now, you know, I'm incorporating text almost half and half now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with, because now that I've kind of been, like, hip to, or more aware of what's out there, and exploring like just a lot of amazing artists out there, and you know, letting my friends bring me stuff that they like, and just checking things out. It's interesting because I've read more interviews with comics, with comic artists or illustrators, than I've actually seen their work. You know, really, mm-hmm. It's so I've been kind of getting into that a little bit more, just kind of thinking about. Not just expressing more in a personal way. And the other thing that kind of changed it too was when Jamie Solomon from Drawing Quarterly, when he interviewed me, he asked me if I ever would do a narrative comic and all this kind of stuff. And I said, no, I'm not going to, because I can't stick with one character. It always has to shift for me. And I'm really bad at writing narratives, and I'm not good with text. And as soon as I said that, or actually I wrote it, it was an email. I wrote that, and I was thinking about it for a while. I was like, well, then that's something I have to try.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's not a narrative thing, that's something I have to think about doing in the future. Just because if I tell myself that I'm not capable of doing it, or it's not something I do, then maybe it's something I should actually, you know, try.
Just trying to push yourself in different directions.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, one thing that's neat about the book is it seems like a lot of parts, your characters, shapes, they all kind of exist in their own world.
Mm.
It kind of seems like you mentioned earlier, like the advertising influence.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like a dystopian.
Yeah,
I don't even want to use dystopia, but there's such like weird, like happy pop imagery with like someone's penis being chopped off. It was
yeah, like, you know, it's kind of funny, and it's like I try to include some of that stuff in maybe more as subtle a fashion as I can to kind of ride that line, at least for myself. I mean, I know when I think something is right or something is done or an image feels correct. Somehow. And it was very funny because it's interesting that you picked up on that because, to be perfectly honest, I mean, I'm not trying to say that people should read it in a certain way. People can read it however they want. It is, no, it's not up to me. But majority, especially when my friends look at the book, they kind of look and they get a kick out of it and they laugh and they enjoy it, and I think that's great. But definitely for me, it's like when I work on that stuff, it's, I'm not laughing. You know, I'm not necessarily trying to be humorous, and because a lot of it for me is felt sounding, you know, overly, you know, heavy coming down on this whole thing. It's just a lot of it has to do with my experiences with health issues and stuff like that as well, and just like my own experiences. And you know, just like every day, some things are really good and some things are kind of bad. And the only people that I've had consistently actually look at the work that I've been doing and kind of have the same reaction that I do when I'm making it are other people that have mental health issues. Which I found really interesting, because I had some, you know, friends of friends and acquaintances and stuff like that look at the book and be like, like, oh, your work is really, you know, it's really morbid, or like, I can't look at this, it's really disturbing to me, or something like that. Which, funny, everybody else looking at me, I'm like, oh, this is cute.
That's the interesting aspect, because, I mean, one time I interviewed Gary Panter, and we were talking about Kim Deitch's work, and he said he couldn't read his work. Because he couldn't read it, it was just so dark. I mean, all Kim Deitch's stuff, like, surface level, it's poppy, you know, underground, yeah. You know, the seedier side of the early animation industry.
Yeah.
But there is, like, something deeper in there that's...
Yeah, I definitely agree, especially with somebody like his work as well. I remember the first time I was looking at his work, I totally had this overwhelming sense of this really, like, kind of crushing, like, real... I don't want to use maybe necessarily use the word dark, but very introspective and kind of not always the happiest environment mentally from his work. I can't speak for him. Maybe yeah. He's a perfectly, you know, happy guy, but we all have that side.
The monkey,
the yeah.
Monkey on the know. Back.
And the advertising stuff may not... I mean, I kind of approach that in my work anyhow. I mean, my work is all kind of rooted in nostalgia and being a child... For certain, and this particular book, I think started to explore that a little bit more. I'm sorry, like a little bit, and then the new stuff I think would be exploring maybe just a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
When you look at the book, do you have it? Because the way I looked at it, I was going through, I kind of like took it in that kind of comic way, where I went through it in that purposefully sequential order. Is that something when you did the book, was there was kind of an order of development?
That's a good question. It wasn't really on a flipping the page basis, but yeah. I was very careful of how each page next to each other was presented. Was something that was really important to me, that certain things bounced, at least in my mind, they were contrasting or bounced, or in some cases they might have even looked like the same piece, like they could have both pages were one thing, but in fact they were two. So I was kind of really aware of that kind of spatial thing between two pages opposing each other. But in terms of more like of a narrative function, not really so much. but I mean, now that I'm kind of thinking more in terms of books, I'm still not necessarily thinking in terms of a narrative, but I am really liking the idea that you get a whole bunch of stuff in one form.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of It's neat to me that way. Like, I like that idea. And as well, like, people don't, you know, like, I think there's power in numbers. I think sometimes the ideas work en masse. And I kind of now think of a book as, you know, I was like in art school, like, you think about a painting. And I still do this. I mean, I think about every piece, or whatever you want to call it, every section, page, or whatever, a lot. But I like the idea that when it's all put together, that you have something that's kind of greater than the sum of its parts. And the fact that it's affordable for people too. It's not like just buying a painting, you know.
One thing that's really neat about the book is that, I guess, the fullness of the page. And I'm wondering how, like, some of the stuff that goes right to the bleed, like right to the edge of the page, how does that reflect the original piece? Is that verbatim, or is it a section of something bigger?
It's pretty much actually verbatim. Actually, there only is one piece in that book. That was, I don't know exactly what, maybe I sent them the wrong file, but was like cropped and is only about 25% of the piece. And the rest of it is like, just does not exist. It just, I mean, it goes off a page for like another page. It's really just like, it's like a zoom in on the center. And I never tell anybody which piece that is, because I don't really know if it really matters. And people probably can't tell anyhow for the most part, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, most of the pieces, they go right off the edge. Now I'm kind of honing in a little bit. I'm putting everything, placing it onto a page. And it was nice getting the book back because I could see how everything kind of worked. And I kind of was saying to people when I first was working on this one that I wanted it to be, at least in my mind, kind of like epileptic almost. Like I wanted it to be like kind of too much.
Busy.
Yeah, like just, I wanted it to be a little overwhelming because I think at the time I was feeling quite overwhelmed.
I get that feeling too, especially with like some of the repetitive imagery use, like the triangles.
Yeah.
You seem to have a big thing for, was it like prisms, I guess?
Prisms, yeah. There was a lot of that stuff that was coming out and the multiple things, which is funny because another thing that was still when Jamie was asking me about the the various repeated patterns, and I said, I don't really know what those are about. I have my ideas about what exactly they're about, and they do stand for things. But as soon as we had that interview, they kind of just disappeared as well. Like, I just kind of just, you know, I just worked. Just
yeah.
Sit down and just start going to see what happens. And they just kind of vanished. But now they've been kind of coming back a little bit, too. So, but the multiples thing I'm interested in, for sure.
Tell me about the characters in your drawing. The little guy and the girl.
Oh, wow, that's a good question, actually. That is a really good question, actually. I mean, I think a lot of the characters that I'm using, I mean, a friend of mine said that, you know, they look very familiar, and yet they don't look familiar.
They're kind of like that subgenius, you know, like the Bob, the guy with the picture with the guy with the pipe.
Yeah,
I kind of get that feeling from it.
Yeah, totally. And which is something I'm attracted to, and I think it's not necessarily a particular. I think I could have gone in any style, per se. But I always like that stuff. I mean, I like things that kind of seemed timeless or things that seemed innocent, but at the same time, stuff that is also built to be subversive. And I mean, even talking about advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big collector, and I collect a lot of, well, crap, basically. And I collect a lot of stuff, and I don't have any specialized market, but...
if it looks neat, grab it.
Yeah, if it looks neat, grab it. And especially, you know, I mean, I collect anything from the 1920s to the 1980s, but I'm mostly focused on children's stuff, and that could be packaging or games or toys or books or whatever. And especially advertising, I like looking at those old bottles and looking at little stuff, because especially, I mean, those characters are designed to entice you.
Yeah.
I mean, especially for kids, you know, they're supposed to be cute. They make them look like kids, and it's kind of like, you know, like, hey, try this chocolate syrup. Like, it's totally Tops or whatever. Like, they're trying to bring you in. I mean, they want you, the kids, to grab it and go like, Mom, can I get the chocolate syrup? It says right here, like, this is
the shit,
Mom.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, this chocolate syrup is incredible. It says here, moms love it too. Like, you know, it's all that kind of culture, I think, kind of starting from the 50s. And I don't necessarily say that the people making this stuff were trying to be subversive by any means. I think they're just trying to do their job, which is, we got kids to buy this. What do kids like? They like elephants, cake, great, put an elephant on this box, and there we go.
It's like the old comic adage, if one time they thought if you put a monkey on the, or a gorilla on the cover, sales would go up. They put all these terrible comics
really?
With gorillas on the cover.
That is awesome. I should try that for the next book. I should just put a gorilla on the cover and just see if sales increase. that's really funny, actually. But yeah, it's the same kind of thing, you know, for me. Because our generation, I mean, I'm 28, I mean, we are still, you know, a lot of we still grow up in the, you know, the kind of like, the detritus of the 60s and 70s, you know. I mean, we still have Warner Brothers cartoons. I mean, a lot of those cartoons you can't even see anymore.
Because they're so racist.
They're so racist, you know what I mean? I couldn't believe it. I was thinking the other day, I was like, where
Tom and Jerry with the mammy?
Yeah, and I was thinking the other day, I was like, you know, why the fuck is Speedy Gonzales these days? Like, you don't see him anymore. Like, he's,
so they,
you know,
put up that fence on the border.
Yeah, exactly. Stay in your own country, mouse.
The Minutemen or whatever they're called.
Yeah. That's right, those guys too. I mean, like, you know, the Minutemen. Those militia guys, I like it. So patriotic, isn't it? They just have too much time on our hands.
Thank God we're in Canada.
Yeah, no kidding. America's a scary place. And I think that's partially indicative of it too. I mean, the fact that some of these cartoons are banned. I mean, I think it was the Cartoon Network in the States who were going to do, a couple years ago, I read that they were going to do a thing where they're going to air every Bugs Bunny cartoon ever made. Every single one.
Including Bugs Bunny Nips the Nips?
Yeah, every single one. And Warner Brothers came down on them like a hammer.
Hell,
obviously.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, they're just not allowed. They're not allowed to do that because, you know, that's part of history you don't want to think about. I mean, those cartoons, luckily, are still available.
It's like that part. I hate references because it's a little cheesy. But in Ghost World, the movie where the Steve Buscemi character is collecting all the blackface chicken stuff. That was it, Popeye's chicken?
Yeah.
So it's kind of that looking back at the past and just this seedy underbelly to it.
Yeah, totally. And like a lot of that stuff, I mean, it's built for entertainment purposes. I mean, those generalizations are built for entertainment purposes. I mean, yeah. My friend works at an antique store and I was the other day and they have this crazy blackface carnival home kind of thing. And it's a wooden face with like, you know, with like a black guy's face on it, you know, like they're as like stereotypically racist as you can get. But the eyes and the teeth all are wooden and they all fall back and it's actually a dartboard. So you throw darts at it and you knock out the eyes and the teeth. And we were talking about this because I looked at it and I said, that's just the most incredible object. I mean, it's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. I mean, it's so charged with the whole, you know, psyche and
just the hatred.
The hatred and even just like the kind of like general ignorance of another time period, another place. I mean, we can say ignorance now, but at the time, those people, it was just a joke item in the way that you had, you know, like the baseball team with the chief guy on it or like Speedy Gonzales. I mean, it's just these things kind of are out in the open. But it means people are very eager to kind of sweep that stuff away.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily interested in exploring myself some of that subversive side. I think maybe like somebody like Robert Crumb has done a good enough job of taking on that whole kind of department.
Or he's kind of exploring his own personal psyche.
And I think he does such an amazing... And that's one reason why his work is so incredible, is because like, everybody can relate to it.
It's honesty.
Mm-hmm, totally. It's really humanist, you know? It's like Richard Pryor or something like that. You really get a sense of the person as a person, whether you agree or disagree. But I think, you know, for me, I mean, just that advertising stuff and all that kind of stuff, I mean, your environment as a kid informs you so much.
You're one of those Saturday morning kids?
Yeah.
I remember those days.
I just think about them last week. I was like, I don't know what cartoons are like.
They don't have them anymore. It's all golf.
Really?
You go to watch TV during the day? Or like Saturday morning before noon? It's all golf. Or like weird like reality shows for kids.
See, that's just twisted. I still remember, like, was it in the mid-90s, and we were getting up one early one Saturday morning. I was probably possible I hadn't even gone to bed yet. I was a teenager, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember my friends were getting out and watching Saturday morning cartoons. You know, like, you know, drinking or smoking weed or whatever. And I was watching it and just being like, man, these cartoons are really crappy.
Oh, yeah.
And the toys looked horrible as well. And I mean, obviously, it's a nostalgic thing. I mean, I'm sure if I talk to kids that grew up with it now, they've been like, I love that.
Well,
Neon Monstrosity or whatever.
I grew up with the Ninja Turtles, and looking back at that now.
Yeah, which is funny, because that was a pretty dark comic, too. Darker than the cartoon, let's just say.
And how.
Yeah. Cowabunga, dude. Yeah, I kind of grew up right around then, too. Maybe that was the tail end of it, I'm not too sure, but...
Yeah, you're 2 years younger than me, so I'm 30.
Okay, yeah, well, it was rather the same time. I remember that. I remember when the movies came out and everything like that, too. And Ninja Turtle movies. Buying all the toys.
Having the playset with the pipes.
The playset with the pipes. You know, actually, the toy series that really got me going as a kid, and what actually kind of really turned me on to comics in a big way, bigger than just Archie and Garfield, which I still consider to be, I mean, whether people want to think about Archie and Garfield or not, I mean, in terms of thinking about comics, are like huge cultural influences on people. Mm-hmm. And the whole culture of like Garfield especially is this incredibly dense and weird. We kind of get right down to it. But it was a Dick Tracy movie that came out with Warren Beatty and Madonna and stuff. And I think it was the visuals of that movie that kind of, and the craziness of those characters, and that was kind of when I went out and bought right away. They, you know, they're trying to cash in, so they put out like the celebrated cases of Dick Tracy, and I went and I bought it. And I didn't realize until years later that they had truncated all the stories. Like the story about Flat Top, they get to the end, and then I was like, oh, that's kind of a weird way to end the story. He's like in the hospital and he's bleeding, and that's kind of it. I didn't realize the guy died. I didn't know he took off and like went to that boat and drowned in that boat or whatever. Like, I really had no idea at the time, because they just, you know, truncated it for the cash. But that was Chester Gould Gould was like, his work is so incredible.
He's crazy.
I heard he was really, yeah.
There's in the newest issue of Mineshaft, this great kind of zine, but underground comics, and underground comics guys do stuff for, like, Crumb. They're the only people that do new stuff by Crumb, except for Fantagraphics or New York Times. But their latest one has a story of Crumb, and I forget what the other one was. Is Crumb, maybe Jay Lynch? But don't get me wrong, but they go and visit Chester Gould in his office. This is like this. Read the story. It's fantastic.
I'd love to read that, actually. Because his whole... his compositions, too, of every panel. I mean, his inventiveness. I'm still waiting for them. I know they put out the collected volumes. Yeah. I'm still waiting for them to hit 19, like, World War II era. Because to me, that's, like, the best period for me. Like, that's my favorite. Like, I think that's when the drawings to me seem so...
He goes really crazy in the end, and, like, isn't there space stuff or something?
Yeah, there's space, and there's, like, this moon girl and stuff. That's... He got a little... I don't know if he was still writing it or involved that time. The other two other guys take over for a while. They kind of rehashed a bunch of old characters, like Flat Top Jr. So, like, come on, guys. I mean, the guy came up with original characters for, like, you know, like 30 years, just pumping out, like, you know, 20 years, 25 years, pumping out original characters, you know, every couple of weeks. And then you new guys take over and, like, all right, Flat Top Jr., like, Flat Top Jr., Jr., whatever, like...
Hey, I'm still reading Batman.
Batman, yeah.
That's the third Robin.
I like Super Friends type Batman. That's my favorite costume.
I love the Super Friends as a kid. There's another... Oh, that's a crappy cartoon. You watch that.
That was a really bad cartoon.
That's a stinker. So, tell me, you were mentioning before I started recording, you've got another book you're working on now.
Yeah, I have another one I'm working on now, which kind of, you know, came as a real... delightful surprise that they asked me to do another one, and it was really, really quickly.
Oh, nice.
Like, it was just like the first book was out in the East Coast in November last year. Like, kind of a funny side story is, to be perfectly honest, I hadn't even had a chance to approve like a press copy or,
yeah,
like
a galley or whatever.
Yeah, or just kind of thing. Like, it was just kind of like, yeah, we're going to send you a copy. I love you guys. I'm not trying to badmouth anybody. But, you know, like, we'll send you a copy. You just proof it. We'll send you a proof. And then I hadn't even seen the proof, and the book showed up in the mail. Luckily, it was perfect. I was very happy about it. It was out on the East Coast, and I didn't even really know it was available. Excuse me. And literally, like, it was, like, a couple weeks ago. Like, yeah, so, like, we can't fly out here this time. But, you know, for the next one, we'll fly out here. And I was like, okay.
The next one.
I was like, all right. This looks like it's on. When they actually put my picture up in the roster artist, that was like...
That
to me was like...
Up there with Charles Burns.
Yeah, that was crazy. I'm like, there's Gary Panter or whatever, you know? And I'm like, holy smokes. Like,
everyone's up there.
I was like, this is...
You're probably right next to Chris Ware.
I think I might even be right next to Chris Ware. Which is really weird. I mean, I'm like looking at this thing and it's like all these people and then there's me who's like a nobody compared to me, really. You know, so the next book, I mean, I'm trying to take a different tack on it a little bit more. I'm exploring the kind of the advertising stuff a little bit more. I'm starting to explore text a little bit more, as well as kind of do more kind of like a personal history thing, because the first book came out of a number of situations and dreams and, like, you know, like hallucinations and stuff like that. Like,
psychedelics big for you when you were a kid? A teenager, I mean, not a kid.
Actually, no, to tell you the truth. They really weren't. I experimented with some drugs pretty heavy from when I was like 14 to 17, and then when I was 17, it turned out I was crazy. And, you know, I mean, I kind of say that in jest too. I mean, I wasn't completely gone, but, you know, I had a really, really hard number of years. And, you know, it still kind of affects me. Like, that's one of the things, when they couldn't fly me out, I was, like, really relieved. I was like, oh, thank God they can't fly me out. Because that means I have to have to leave the house. Because for the most part, like, you know, I mean, I'm an agoraphobic, so...
Oh, okay.
I mean, I hardly ever leave. I mean, I haven't left the city confines in, like, God knows how long. I mean,
I've got two close friends growing up that are agoraphobic.
Yeah, it's a weird condition. I mean, it's a symptom of other things I have to deal with, but it is a weird thing, and it definitely shrinks your environment in such a way and makes you very controlling over your environment in such a way. I think the first book is very kind of, to me, I see it and I'm like, I just see it. And I'm like, yeah, I can see it, and it's just kind of, that's what it is. And I think in the new book, I kind of wanted to, Well, I wanted to air out a little bit more. You know, with some text, I'm not into, like, trying to be a bleeding heart or trying to tell people what my life is really hard, because it's not. I mean, everybody's life is hard. I guess some people may have an easy life, but probably not many people. Like, you know, like, everybody's got something they have to deal with in some fashion or another. So I think the next book, I just kind of wanted to explore that more, even with text, even if it's more in an oblique kind of fashion. Because my favorite art, I mean, whether it's comic or fine art or whatever, is, to me, it's always something that's very simple and it's very bold and has a statement, but you're left with more questions than you are answers. It just makes you think more about yourself than about the person making it. So I set up some pretty ambitious projects for myself for the next book. I want it to be bigger, and probably, funnily enough, it ends up going to be more in a format of a Garfield comic, actually. It's going to be that kind of longer format, which is not really a format I really like. I like it for Garfield. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I never liked those Garfield, the big ones that they put out.
Garfield Treasuries.
Yeah, the Treasuries. I was
sad at myself for knowing that.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't, and you, because I was maybe not so into it as I thought it was.
I read them as a kid, voraciously.
Yeah, kids still do. Yeah. That's the thing. Kids still go crazy over Garfield. And I still love Garfield. I mean, I know Garfield's come up in this conversation like 4 or 5 times already, but there's something I like, and that's maybe it's one of the reasons why I'm kind of going with that format for that book. But, you know, I mean, I think if I could do anything that people would enjoy as much as a kid could enjoy, or a person could enjoy, maybe not an adult. A lot of people don't really like Garfield, after all. Garfield's kind of become like an ironic thing to like.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to like, just to like. But if I could do something that, you know, people could kind of sink back and think about with the same intensity as a Garfield comic, let's say. Which sounds stupid.
You haven't seen the Garfield mishmash website where they take them and rearrange the panels.
Oh, the Garfield...
Or just change the middle panel and it still makes...
Yeah, the Garfield randomizer.
Yeah.
The coding for that just went back up on the web. If you Google Garfield randomizer, you will come to find a site with the Garfield randomizer on it. And I think it's probably one of the greatest things that's happened to that strip for years. Because, I mean, really, that strip's been dead since, like, 90. You know, it's kind of like...
Well, does he even do it anymore?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Garfield was even... he was created as a media device, as a marketing device, basically. Yeah. I mean, Jim Davis is not a cartoonist. He's a marketing guy. I mean, just happens to be able to draw that damn cat. And loves lasagna, you know. And there's been a resurgence of Garfield recently with the lasagna cat, too, and everything like that, so...
This is like the Garfield.
I might as well just interview Jim Davis as interviewing me.
Let's just talk. Maybe recommend people read the Pete Bag. What's the comic he did? The Sweatshop, just to cleanse yourself after.
Mm-hmm. Impossible. Well, I mean, I do kind of like. I mean, to me, my work. I don't want to say it lies the same way. I mean, obviously, I'm not doing a syndicated comic of like kind of bizarro now. Ridiculously horrible, you know, 3-panel humor. But I do like the idea that if I'm going to work on something that hopefully people, whether they're interested in comics or not, will hopefully get a sense of something bigger than, I don't know, life or something. It sounds so grandiose or something, you know. But yeah, that's kind of feel like I try and get out of it, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think art is really like a therapy, really. I mean, there's lots of different schools of thought on that. I mean, I think it can be therapeutic for the most part. I mean, I think that shit's really stressful. I mean, I have to work at it every day, or else if I don't, I mean, I'll lose it.
Well, it's interesting when you read like people's sketchbook work, just seeing what goes into the mindset of doing the art, and it's so challenging for so many just incredible artists that just have such a hard time with it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It is.
So many people that just pump out tons of stuff, but it's so private to themselves as well.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the idea as well, I think it's tough. I mean, maybe it's different because, you know, like if I'm writing some music and stuff like that, I mostly write like stuff that's children's music for the most part. It's like electronic, but it's children's music. And it feels personal, but because it's music, you don't really have that. You don't have that text in there. Maybe in the first book, I maybe wasn't really ready to explore that quite yet in some fashion. I'm not really too sure. Maybe it was just a chicken. I don't really know.
Taking it to the next level.
To the next level. Always, you know, going forward. But it's tough. I mean, you look at somebody like, dozens of artists to put something personal on paper.
Yeah.
And present it, whether it's in a story form or not, and then present it to the public and have people. It's not like, you know, looking at abstract painting, it's kind of like, you know, it goes very personal to me. And everybody else is like, what the hell is, you know, like.
You're just dripping paint.
Yeah, you know, I mean, some people might get a kick out of it, some people might really hate it. It doesn't really matter, but you kind of, you do have that defense that there's nothing quite literal about it. Mm-hmm. You put words down, people are automatically going to read into things anyhow. But words, especially, you could just say it's semantics or whatever, but people, there's going to be something there that people are going to take from it very literally when you're drawing something.
Yeah, well, like in your first book, the word stuff there, like I got a lot of sense of anxiety, and then after you mentioning being agoraphobic, makes complete sense to me.
Which is interesting. I mean, I've always kind of hoped that hopefully that kind of knowledge wouldn't be crucial to understand this stuff. That hopefully, if you knew it, would maybe be helpful. Or you might get
it. Well, I did. It's a sense I got, though, from reading it.
That is interesting.
Yeah. That is because I do what I do for a living, too.
So. That is true. Because most people are just like, it's really cute. And I'm like, I sweated blood for that thing. Hillary. You know, and for the new book, I'm definitely going to be trying to explore more advertising stuff. More exclusively, as well as I'm trying to make it simpler. Kind of rein everything in a little bit. Give the whole thing some context and just kind of see where it goes. I mean, I might send it to those guys and I'll be like, hey, this totally sucks. <You know?
laughs> So, about that second book, we'll plan it out for 2050.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to put out a newsprint and just use it to stuff some boxes. Is that okay?
Oh.
We'll see. You know, I mean, now that it's been happening, everything's kind of picking up in a way. I want to keep it going. I'm trying to plan for another show.
Do you have any scheduled coming up? Or?
Well, no. I mean, I'm talking with the gallery right now. And I really hope that they say, yes, let's do it. But it is a different world. Mm-hmm. It's been a real learning experience for me, talking with the curator. Lance, if you're listening, please give me the show. And, you know, other people that it's a different thing, kind of thinking about a book and thinking about big pieces.
It's a whole different. I did I curated an art show at the beginning of the year at the Jam. Mm. And just trying to, like, plan that out and just seeing what would work and, you know, trying to focus on just that immediacy compared with a story where it would be different people that I want to have.
Yeah, totally. And so I think luckily, you know, I mean, I would like just display some stuff. I mean, luckily, I think unlike some comic artists, like, they don't maybe have the best penmanship but have a great storyline, it would be hard for them to do a show. I'm just guessing because it's hard to put up just a page of a book. And you might get a sense of a piece of it, but unless they're, you know, a real good drafts person, the average person looking at it, they might not get that much, sadly. So, luckily, my work tends to be one-offs. They don't really tend to be narratives. Or if the narrative's there, it's, like, so loose that it doesn't even seem linear. I mean, when I started
it's
working...
emotion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I work on the new book...
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We don't know what just happened there. It seemed we had a little bit of a power surge, and unfortunately has cut off that interview with Ink Studs. right here on CITR. With only 9 minutes remaining, though, that's kind of a downer because we're just about at the end of another edition of the show. So it's now forcing me to actually try to talk to you and maintain some kind of continuity for the remainder of this broadcast. We'll see if we can get it up and running within the last 8 minutes here, folks. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We'll try to be right back right here on Inkstuds, CITR 101.9 FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Fun!
While
Fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains
Fun. Fun
devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet
Fun
doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed. But a word of caution, handle it with care and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs, operating at any level, any time, anywhere, and with anybody. Who are they?
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Photocopies of the drawings, and I made myself personally. I was at the peak of my
All right. Sorry about that, folks. We're not able to bring back Inkstud's interview that was unceremoniously interrupted by the power surge we just had here in the station. We apologize for any inconvenience that may have caused the Inkstud's regular listeners. But if you do visit inkstuds.com, that again is www.inkstuds.com, you'll be able to listen to the entire interview all over again. We only really had about 4 minutes left to go in the interview, but of course, everyone hanging by a thread, I'm sure, on the bated breath of both Robin and his guest. You can check out again that interview on www.inkstuds.com. We apologize again for any inconvenience this may have caused, but in the meantime, we'll just play you some more music until our next show, which of course is Crimes and Treasons right here on CITR 101.9 FM. She will fly, what can you do?